Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning, we talk about the need for food and becoming more food resilient. We sit down with the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. She's here for FESPAC 2024. We learn about initiatives around the issues that connect our Pacific Island neighbors. And the call for volunteers for the event, including a need for French speakers. We talked to an instructor with the Alliance Française of Hawaii about events to promote the French language and culture. Did you know French is one of the official languages of the Summer Olympics? And it's not just because the games there are in Paris this year. And a feature film that made waves on the film festival circuit is headed to local theaters this weekend for a limited run. It's already playing in theaters in Texas. We'll hear why. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Local food banks are a crucial part of the state's disaster response network. HVR Savannah Harriman Pote joins us today to talk about how food providers are preparing for the next major crisis. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yeah, so this is something that I wanted to look into because we're trying to figure out how all the different aspects of our disaster response system in the state are looking ahead to what the big next bad thing might be. And so I spoke to Kristen Frost Albrecht, who heads up the Hawaii Food Basket on Hawaii Island. And I said to her, you know, what are you guys looking ahead for in terms of the next disaster? And she said, we're really still dealing with the repercussions of the last disasters that we've experienced over the last 10 years. When you look at the last decade, the Big Island community has just been hit by one disaster after another.
Starting in 2014 with Hurricane Izelle, that was a federally declared disaster, followed by the Kilauea lava eruption in 2018, followed by Hurricane Lane, and then followed by the long-lasting pandemic. So each one of those disasters has built on the other one, and it's been hard for people to catch their breath.
Yeah, they just can't, you know, get a break.
No. And so Kristen and her colleagues at the Hawaii Food Basket are really just treating disaster as the new normal. And in 2021, the Food Basket's board actually got together to create a new strategic plan that reflects this kind of new status quo. And they're amping up a lot of different disaster planning measures, including building a new campus, which is specifically outside the tsunami evacuation zone in Hilo. And the Food Basket is just one of many food banks that are trying to beef up this kind of disaster planning. So I also spoke with Rachel Carroll. She's the emergency planning coordinator for the Hawaii Food Bank, which serves Kauai and Oahu. And that food bank and its partners are part of this cohort of 27 different groups that are working on how to keep food assistance going during devastating events like hurricanes, floods, and wildfires. And all of this spring, they've been meeting together. And they've had speakers from big organizations like Feeding America's Disaster Services Team, as well as representatives from food banks in Puerto Rico, which, of course, has just been convulsed by different disasters.
Right. So what was the takeaway there?
Well, Rachel said that the number one takeaway was redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. So don't be reliant on any one system. And that applies to everything from making sure that facilities have backup powers in case an outage impacts refrigeration to store food, but also to developing multiple ways in and out of communities in case a major highway or evacuation route is blocked during a disaster. And that latter situation is something that the Hawaii Food Basket has experienced on Big Island. Here's Kristen again.
You know, that whole stretch between Honaunau and Ocean View is very, very isolated. Anything can happen along there and folks can be cut off. We try and factor that in. Again, for us, what's key is partnership. During the pandemic, we partnered with the National Guard. We partnered with the state police. We partnered with civil defense, of course, with the county service groups. And with between all those folks, I feel like we're always able to find a way to get to where we need to be. Sometimes that means during lava, certainly helicopters were being utilized to do drops on occasion.
Yeah, whatever you need to do to get the food where it's needed.
Yeah, Rachel said that part of their planning is just identifying community groups and community members who have things like boats and ATVs for communities on Oahu or Kauai that might be cut off. And something else that Rachel and Kristen emphasized, when there's a disaster, people can very, very quickly backslide into food insecurity. And when we see disasters stack up on top of each other, like we're starting to see in some of our communities, people never really get the chance to recover. And that has consequences for disaster preparedness.
Yeah, I mean, I recall, you know, growing up with typhoons, you eat well the first couple of days because your freezer and your refrigerator is, you know, not functioning. But then, yeah, you rely on canned food.
Yeah, right. And that's assuming that you have the ability to have food on hand at all, right? The emergency officials are constantly telling people to have 14 days of food on hand. And how do you do that if you're struggling to put dinner on the table? And there's a lot of people in that situation. So, for instance, HBR's very own Mark Ladau recently covered a survey from the Hawaii Food Bank that shows that almost one in three households in our state are facing food insecurity. And for places like Big Island, that number is as high as 40%. So Rachel from Hawaii Food Bank says this is a huge issue when it comes to personal disaster planning.
Our baseline is to help address the daily disaster of hunger that families primarily on Oahu and Kauai are facing. The food bank knows and serves a lot of families that don't have the means to prepare. But for the families that do have the means, their ability to prepare not only helps that family have what they need to get through, the immediate need within a disaster, but it also frees up more resources for organizations like the food bank to be able to meet the needs of the families that don't have the resources to prepare in advance.
And we should probably remind everybody that, you know, we're in June and that's the start of hurricane season.
Absolutely. So these things are only going to become more top of mind as we move deeper into the summer.
And so, gosh, I mean, this I'm sure is not just a problem, you know, here locally, but across the country as well.
Absolutely. And many food banks have had troubles meeting the demand that they saw spike during COVID. So, for instance, I think at its peak, the Hawaii Food Basket on Hawaii Island was serving roughly 80,000 people during COVID. That's now dropped down to 60,000 people on a monthly basis, which really is a quarter of the population of the island. And one of the challenges of disaster planning, right, we talked about trying to get food into communities, but you also have to make sure that you're able to get food to food banks. So if there's a disaster that, for instance, disrupts the port of Oahu and we can't bring in imports of shelf-stable foods, are we going to be able to rely on local supplies of foods? That's something that a lot of food banks are making investments in as well. And the food bank campus, its new campus, is 24 acres in Hilo. And they are going to use part of that land to be able to grow some of their own supplies of food. So they have kind of a local stock that they can use to be more resilient in that type of instance.
And I know the push to get communities to be more resilient, I believe it's, over here on Oahu on the windward side, where they're trying to get folks in the Haula, La'ie side to plant breadfruit, right? So that's a staple that you can hopefully have that to tap into, when you don't have other things, in your hurricane preparedness kit.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is partnership, too. You know, disasters put a halt on many businesses. We saw that during COVID. We've seen that when other disasters, such as the August 2023 wildfires, impacted Maui. Sometimes there's a slowdown for restaurants. Can we transition some of that food back towards local communities who need it? A lot of food banks are trying to put themselves in those conversations as well.
Yeah, pandemic certainly taught us a lot. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Check out her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Shelley Lowe heads the National Endowment for the Humanities, some liken her to a fairy godmother who gets to fund some of the most interesting cultural programs across the country that aims to enrich our lives. Lowe is here for FESPAC 2024, which officially kicks off tomorrow and runs for the next 10 days. She stopped by our studios yesterday afternoon to talk to us about projects across the Pacific that the federal agency hopes to fund.
Aloha. I am so excited to be here on the ground to be having this conversation to talk about what we do at National Endowment for Humanities, but also to really specifically talk about some of the work we do in Hawaii and now our outreach into our Pacific Islands. So we are the National Endowment for Humanities. We are the federal agency that funds humanities projects initiatives across the country. We fund institutions like libraries, universities, museums. We also fund researchers, so individual researchers who are doing work in humanities field. We support digital humanities. And we also have 56 state and jurisdictional partners, councils that are in each of the states and jurisdictions that we fund, and they do amazing work on the ground. So it's been really exciting. We have a really far reach. We're a very small agency. We get our funding from Congress, and, you know, we have a set of competitive application grants or grant lines that we fund, but our state humanities councils also do funding for projects in their states.
And then you have one currently centered around the climate initiative, right?
We do. So when I started, I began my position in February of 2022. And when I came in, you know, we were paying attention to the Biden-Harris administrative priorities and really thinking about what our contemporary challenges are right now. And talking with the staff, some of the program directors, they helped to create what we have called, the initiative is called American Tapestry, Weaving Together Past, Present, and Future. And it focuses on three of the challenges that we really do see as coming to the forefront for Americans. So strengthening our democracy is one, advancing equity for all, and confronting our changing climate and using humanities tools and the humanities field to really focus on these issues that we're dealing with. So under our kind of climate initiative, we're doing two things. One is helping organizations to mitigate. So we have a new program. It's called Climate Smart Humanities Organizations. And it allows organizations like museums, libraries, archives, humanities centers to develop strategic climate action plans so they can plan for the future, so they can plan for what they might have to anticipate in terms of the changing climate. The second new program we have is called Cultural and Community Resilience Grants, and this is to support how do we assess our cultural heritage and how do we protect our cultural heritage, especially as we think about the changing climate and what does that mean to our cultural heritage. So really safeguarding these resources that we have in communities and making sure that we are able to preserve the knowledge that comes out of our cultural heritage for the future.
So it's not just how do we protect our artifacts and our treasures that are in some of these institutions and the challenges to protect them, whether it's, you know, you digitize something and right. Then what if that machine doesn't right. work anymore or is not made?
Right.
But then it's also the boots on the ground, Pacific Islanders who are seeing the land disappear and the seas go up higher.
Yeah. And some of the cultural knowledge that we lose as we see our landscape changing. So adapting, right, that's the second part of our climate work. Mitigation was the first, and adaptation is the second one. How do we really prepare ourselves?
Well, the island that I'm from Guam, we used to build our hale, our huts, up on lattice stones. And they were limestone columns, and they were built up, and which I thought, gosh, that makes a lot of sense.
Right?
But then to realize, wow, we're the only Pacific island that does that.
Yeah. You know, how do we think about that kind of knowledge, particularly that indigenous knowledge that is not shared as widely or is maybe not known? And how do we kind of bring that forward so that we can all be thinking about what we need to prepare for? I think we're really looking to the Pacific Islands to kind of give us a little bit of insight of what's happening and what we need to be looking forward to.
And you are here to also take part in the FESPAC 2024. Yes. And I understand that you're going to be making some announcement as part of the kickoff this weekend.
We are. So I'm here. This is my second trip to Hawaii this year. I was here at the end of April. When I started as chair, I had come in after spending 6 years on the National Council. And in that 6 years, I had a really, you know, a very good sense of the applications that were coming in for our competitive federal funding. I had a good sense of the institutions that were being funded or recommended for funding. And I had a really good sense of all the institutions that did not get recommended for funding. And one of the things that, you know, I came in just hoping and thinking, I just want to be able to fund all those organizations that we haven't been funding, like all the underserved organizations. And these were often small institutions. These were often rural communities. These were often, you know, programs and centers that might have one full-time staff, but then the rest were volunteer. But they were doing amazing work, right? And I wanted to be able to say, yes, we fund that kind of work. And I want individuals and institutions to know that NEH is for all organizations. It's not just for the large, well-known institutions. But the other part of that was, what are the communities that we have not been reaching? And one of the communities in particular that I felt we had very little knowledge about, we were not getting applications from, and we were not doing much funding into these areas, were the Pacific Islands and our Pacific Island jurisdictions. So I had conversations again with the staff, and we have jurisdictional councils in Guam, in CNMI, and America Samoa, and we have a state council here in Hawaii. We had a conversation with them as well to say, you know, if we were to really help support you, what would that look like? What would you need? And they went back and they had conversations among themselves. And, you know, they came forward and said, yes, we need some support. There are a lot of things that we want to do. And here's what we think can happen. So on Saturday, we are going to be hosting an event where our councils through the Pacific Islands are going to sign a memorandum of understanding to create the Pacific Island Cultural Initiative and to create a network where they will be able to share information, they will be able to share resources among the islands, knowledge, some of that knowledge that we just talked about. They're going to do work that will amplify Pacific voices, not just in the work that they're doing, but also nationally for all of us. And they'll be looking specifically also at cultural protection, climate resilience, but building capacity and professional development. So we're going to be supporting this. We've supported this with about $1.3 million to help them really do this work. Some of that does include funding to help with the recovery of the Maui fires and some of the recovery from Typhoon Mawar in Guam. So, you know, we're really kind of trying to shine a big, bright spotlight on the work that the Pacific Islands are doing, the knowledge that they hold, and bring them together so that they can just strengthen all of that work.
Yes, because I think we often feel overlooked when there are big anniversaries or big events that the country highlights. They highlight the main stories, yes, the main narratives, and not so much the underserved,
yes,
communities.
Exactly.
And those stories can be just as powerful.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of this work falls back under that equity for all, right? So bringing those undertold stories forward so that we can all learn, right? It just makes our history of this country much more rich and much more, you know, vibrant and beautiful.
That was part of a conversation we had with Shelley Lowe, the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. We'll hear more about programs that are in the funding queue right after a short break.
Fatherhood is getting a makeover in Japan with images that make doting dads look cool.
Makeup.
This is masculinity too, being a good dad.
Can getting dads more involved make a difference in Japan's plummeting birth rate? Next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks FA, we'll delve into a new study about Hawaii's digital economy. We'll find out what the study says about the impact of digital technologies and what Hawaii might do to expand its digital footprint. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Let's get back to our interview with Shelley Lowe. She heads up the National Endowment for the Humanities and is here in the islands to connect with some of the underserved communities in the Pacific. She talked with us about the initiatives with Native Americans whose stories align with Pacific peoples.
One of the things that also occurred right before I started my position, Deb Haaland was sworn in as Secretary of the Interior, and she announced the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative, which was, or is, an initiative to really delve into the history of federal Indian boarding schools in the United States and to bring that history forward. When I came into the position, I said, we absolutely have to support this. It's what we do. It's humanities. This is humanities work, looking at history, looking at stories, thinking about oral history. So we partner now with the Department of the Interior. We provided them $4 million to help digitize all of the federal records that pertain to federal Indian boarding schools. And these are records that are held in the federal archives. In addition to that, some of the funding supported the creation of an oral history project, which is now has been established and is now ongoing. So in this work, I had the opportunity to visit tribal communities with Secretary Haaland and Assistant Secretary Brian Newland to listen to boarding school students who are now elderly talk about, you know, what it was like and to share some beautiful, amazing stories of strength, connection, but stories also of abuse, right? And really just painful, painful stories. And one of the gentlemen who had spoken, you know, rightfully said, you always come to us, federal government, right? You come to us, you listen to us, you go away and nothing happens. You don't come back, or, you know, we don't hear from you again. And I, of course, went back to the staff again and I said, we can't be one of those entities that comes, listens, leaves, and nothing happens. So we created a new CHAIRS grant initiative and program to support tribal communities, tribal organizations, nonprofits who are working with tribes and working with communities to help them delve deeper, if they want, into this history, to help them create exhibits, to help them create their own oral history projects, whatever it is that they felt they needed to do within their communities. And turns out, we've got one project in Hawaii.
Okay, and then that will deal with?
That will deal with the two industrial schools on the North Shore, the Industrial School for Boys and the Industrial School for Girls. And they're going to create kind of an oral history project and a story mapping project.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, we recently featured those schools on a segment on The Conversation. So, yeah, nice to know that the spotlight will be on that history.
Yes. And it was really important that the communities decide for themselves what they needed, right? We can't come in and say, here's what you should do, because the government always does that, right? But we just kind of left it open and let communities and organizations apply and say, this is what we need when we start to deal with this history.
And so, you know, we have yet to really get the FESPAC started, but what's your hope over the next 10 days? What do you hope to bring back to the decision makers there in D.C.?
Well, my biggest hope is that a lot of people from D.C. will be here. I'm not sure how many people from D.C. will be here. You know, one of the things I've had the opportunity now to, I visited New Zealand. I've had the opportunity to work with Pacifica students in my previous positions and to really kind of get an understanding of the real beauty of Pacifica cultures, the connections that they have maintained and their ability to continue to build upon that, to strengthen that considering all of the history that each of these countries, including, you know, the United States, what has happened to kind of really take culture away, take language away, take those understandings of how to be who you are and live your culture. I hope that we can go back and we can point to specific examples that say, this is really the strength of these communities. This is where they are being leaders, particularly in terms of thinking about our global lifestyle, where we are in this world, what we are going to be thinking about for the future. You know, we need to be looking at these communities that have been able to really keep themselves strong and keep their cultures vibrant and growing, and to say there's something that we should be emulating, maybe in some cases. There are other things that we need to be supporting. So, you know, one of the things that we're going to be doing is hosting a panel with some funders, and it'll be, you know, government entities, but it'll also be foundations that will be doing, you know, some interesting work, I hope, coming to listen to talk about what are the issues, where are the areas that we can be funding and supporting the work that's happening in the Pacific Islands, and how can we really join together and say, this is important work and we need to fund it and create new opportunities.
Well, my hope is that this is not seen as just a cultural display, but an opportunity to engage
right.
with each other in a meaningful way.
Right. And to learn, right? I mean, I'm sure I'm going to learn a whole lot in the next few days.
All right. Well, thank you so much for carving out time for us.
Of course. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Mahalo, for inviting me. And it's wonderful. And I can't wait to see everything that's happening and help and ensure everything continues to move forward.
That was Shelley Lowe, chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, who is here for FESPAC 2024, a celebration of culture and arts. We'll continue with our coverage right after a break.
Elbet a nahok a daitsore nase.
FESPAC 2024 recently put out a call for volunteers to help as delegates from close to 24 island nations are in Hawaii. But it was also looking for those with a particular skill, those who speak French. Alliance Française of Hawaii is a nonprofit that celebrates French culture and language. It asks its members to help out with the delegates from French-speaking island nations. Malia Schlesser is the lead instructor for the group. She talked with us about its efforts and the events that the group has planned for the rest of the summer and later this year.
They're looking for any volunteers that are able to speak French or even have some knowledge of French. And then we also have a music festival coming up on June 21st, which is also very nice because it's actually a music festival that's celebrated in not just France, but in many countries in Europe. And it's always on June 21st. So we decided to do that here as well. We have, of course, Bastille Day coming up on July 14th at the Halekulani, which is also a big event. That one is one of the biggest of the year. And then we have another one in August coming up called La Vie en Rosé, not just rose, but rosé. So it's obviously a wine event. For those events, you don't necessarily have to speak French. You know, those are just events that promote the French culture. But then, of course, we have our classes and the workshops and everything. That is where you're learning the languages, because some people just want to be part of the French culture.
I know that people take classes for so many different reasons, including, you know, they may be going to Tahiti or Paris, and you know, there's lots of buzz around the Olympics. Folks are, you know, headed over there, you know, just to see, 'cause it's a big spectacle. But talk about, you know, the classes that you folks offer.
So we have different classes that we offer. First of all, we have classes over Zoom. Those are usually once a week, and we have different levels. We have a beginner's level, an advanced, an intermediate, and a super advanced. And that's really a class where you learn everything. Like you learn how to pronounce verbs, the grammar, conversation, all of that. Then we have also private classes. For the private classes, that's tailored to the person themselves. So I have right now, I am teaching private classes, and some of those students are advanced, like they speak fluent French. So for them, it's more like we can discuss a book, or they would discuss a theme. So those are conversation classes. So those are not people that need to learn how to speak or the grammar. But then we can also do classes in person. So, for example, I have a student that I'm going to be teaching now during the summer in person, because she's actually a high school student who wants to have extra classes, come more fluent in French. So that's going to be in person, because we believe that for the younger crowd, Zoom is not the right way to go. And then, of course, we have our Petit Atelier, which is our summer camp coming up. And that's going to be in July. It's going to be two different sessions. And that's for little ones. So we have one session for kids from 3 to 7 and one for kids from 8 to 12. And that's going to be every day from 9 to 3. And again, these kids also learn French, but it's more, they learn colors and how to say hello. And we teach them songs and animals and body parts. So we have literally a large spectrum of classes we offer. We also have a conversation class that's every Saturday. There's a book club class, so they literally read a book and discuss a book.
So talk more about the children's workshop. Have you folks offered that before, or is it a new thing?
No, we've offered it before. We used to have a location where we were able to have it. So it was every Saturday, and then COVID hit, and then it dissolved. So now we're offering it again, and we're going to be offering it in a two-way format. So number one is during July, so starting on July 8th for 1 week, and then a second workshop the next week, so for 2 weeks total. It's going to be at Unity Church, which is on Montserrat, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And right there, it's going to be for these little kids. And it's every day, Monday to Friday. We're also going to have a field trip. We have to figure out all the details for the excursion. The workshop itself is going on later in the fall. And it's going to be every Saturday. Every Saturday morning, it's for about 2 hours.
So it's a chance for the children to make friends. Maybe some are already know some French, and for some it'd be something new.
Correct. So they can learn French. The group is very diverse. There are, of course, kids that they have one French-speaking parent or two French-speaking parents, and some of them, parents just want them to learn French. Or some kids actually know some French, but then they're like, there's no one else who speaks French. Why should I speak French at home? You know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because kids, they don't like to, suddenly they're like, oh, wow, there's someone else who also speaks French or wants to learn French. So it's a very nice way for kids. And then kids, of course, at that age, they learn quickly, you know,
oh, yes.
And then maybe once they go to school, then they're more ready to learn French because now they've had some basics.
But it's just, you make it fun for them.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, when you have a 3-4-year-old, you're not going to go into like irregular verbs. I mean, that would be, No. So it's like I said, we teach them colors, body parts, animals, and then we have songs that, you know, you can play like Simon Says in French and Head, Shoulders, Knees and Toes, all of that. So we, of course, because otherwise you lose their interest, obviously.
Yeah.
I work with little ones and you need to be, you know, you cannot have them sit there from 9 to 3. So every 20 minutes, you make sure that you make them color or show me something in the room that's rouge, which means red, for example. So then they have to point, you know, and remember the color. So it's like little games, of course. Yes.
Okay. So it's just a good enrichment opportunity for the little ones.
That's exactly what it is. But then we also talk about French culture a little bit. We may, this is the French flag. Every country has a flag, so then they can color the flag, for example, you know, the blue, white, red. And then again, we do the colors, and maybe we'll make them color an Eiffel Tower, and then we'll talk a little bit about it, or things like that.
And then, you know, like I said, with the buzz around the Olympics, you're going to be seeing a lot of that on television as well, the competition. So, yeah, it'd be a fun time this summer with so much going on.
Exactly, especially with the Olympics, because everyone's going to be glued to their television to watch the Olympics. And so they have a little bit of an idea. They're like, oh, my gosh, I understood that word or something. I mean, it depends on the age group, mm-hmm. of course. You know, a little one, 3-year-old, may be acting differently than someone who's 8 or 9, obviously. But then the Olympic Games is very interesting because I think they will also be showing a lot about the city and, you know, like every time there's Olympic Games, they also introduce city and country. Not that, I mean, everyone knows Paris, of course, but they will be doing that for sure. And also the language of the Olympic Games, one of the languages is French, which is interesting because this year they're only going to have two languages. So they're going to be talking in French and then English. If it's somewhere in another country, it's always the host, the country's language, and then French and English. It's always French and English. Those are the two official languages of the Olympic Games, no matter where they are held.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. So really then, it's just a wonderful opportunity to spotlight France in the French language. And Alliance Française is there for people to tap.
Yeah, that's correct. And again, we try and promote the French language and also the French culture. And when I say French culture, I don't necessarily mean French as in France. But for example, my students, I have a section in my book, we talk about Quebec, and then we talk about Belgium, and then there's another section we talk about Switzerland. So all the Francophone countries, and obviously they have different, you know, the food is different, the language may differ a little bit. So we talk about all these countries because there are, I believe, 27 countries in the world that have French as their official language, which is a lot. People always think about France, but there's actually more countries, for example, in Africa who speak French than in Europe, right? So it's interesting.
And that was Malia Schlesher, the lead instructor for Alliance Française of Hawaii. You can check out its website for info on the events and classes, and we'll have links on our website later today. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We've got a ruby red gem of a bird for you today, the northern cardinal. The songbird has been calling Hawaii home since the early 20th century, so you're probably already familiar with its call. Thanks to the Mokulei Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, we've got your Manu Minute. Here's Professor Patrick Hart from the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Northern cardinals are among the most common and recognizable birds in towns, backyards, and even some forests across Hawaii. Introduced to Hawaii in 1929, they're also one of the most abundant birds in North America, though they still don't occur naturally in most of the western states. About 9 inches long from the tip of their bill to the end of their tail, males are a vivid red color with a red crest, a black mask and chin, and a large, bright orange bill. All of these colors are obtained from eating carotenoid pigments in their food. The females also have the bright orange bill, but otherwise are mostly brown, with a bit of red on their wings, tail, and crest. Juveniles can sometimes be mistaken for females, however, their gray-black bills don't turn orange until they're about 3 months old. Males advertise their territorial boundaries and try to impress females with a large variety of songs throughout the year. Most of us in Hawaii have heard these songs, even though we might not realize it was northern cardinals that were making them. See if you can recognize any of these common northern cardinal songs. Also known in Hawaiian as Manu Ula Ula, or redbird, northern cardinals use their large nutcracker-like bills to open large seeds and fruits and to consume a variety of insects. They're among the few non-native birds that can commonly occur in our native forests and are even common in our low-elevation forests where there's too much mosquito-transmitted avian malaria for the native birds to survive. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, a group of people with a passion for supporting the refuge. More about volunteering at friendsofhakalauforest.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dean Radin, author of Real Magic. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about ancient wisdom, modern science, and a guide to the secret power of the universe.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
It's called Big Ben. The feature film takes place in Texas, in the least visited national park in the country. Here in Hawaii, we know it's often all about a sense of place, the smell of the air, the texture of the earth and the sky, the mana of where you stay at any moment. And that's where the story of Big Ben comes into play. It's also the metaphor for a real-life drama between two friends, and it started with the parents' worst nightmare. The characters are in for a big twist. We talked to former Hawaii resident Brett Wagner, the writer and director of the film, about its connections to Hawaii. The movie had a successful screening at the 2021 Hawaii International Film Festival and has won awards on the festival circuit. It opens at Consolidated Theaters at Kahala for a limited run starting Friday.
This was a script that I wrote based on a real-life experience. My producer is from Texas, and his family and my family took a vacation together out in the West Texas desert. And that became the impetus for the story. The main actors are all very well-established Hollywood TV actors. Jason Butler Harner is the lead. He was in Ozark in a really memorable role. And now he's on the show Sugar, which I believe is HBO or Apple TV with Colin Farrell. The little girls in the movie are my daughters, and it was their first time acting. So that was really significant. Other background stuff, the shoot was extremely difficult because we were out in the very, very remote desert in the summertime.
Well, we'll talk about the location of this. And this is a national park?
It is a national park, yeah. We didn't really shoot in the national park that often, but the whole area, which goes on for hundreds and hundreds of miles in all direction, is really beautiful.
Well, tell us about this park.
Okay, so Big Bend and the surrounding area is an iconic part of Texas. It would be hard to stress, especially for somebody living in Hawaii, just how vast the distances are. So to get there, we would fly into El Paso, and then we'd drive for 5.5 hours to get to the town of Terlingua, which is a ghost town. Essentially, it had been a mercury mining town back in the 1800s, early 20th century. Now there's maybe 300 full-time residents. It has a little bit of a life, during rafting season because it's on the Rio Grande. So this is all right by the Mexican border, the Rio Grande River. It's just ranch land. It's a giant national park, the largest national park in the country and the least visited, not for lack of reason to go because it is very beautiful, but just the distance is very daunting. And our locations oftentimes would be 45 minutes to an hour away from where we were all staying, and often on dirt roads, always out of cell range. So you had to make sure you had everything with you before you went, because if you got there, discovered you were missing a little piece of equipment or something, you were going to lose a sizable chunk of the day going back to get it. So it was a very physically daunting place to shoot. We had no choice but to shoot during the summer because all of the actors were working Hollywood actors on successful TV shows. And so summer is when they're on hiatus and when they're free. So we had no choice but to do it then, but that meant it was over 100 degrees most of the time, and we were prepared for that. But the thing we weren't prepared for was these epic lightning storms that would be accompanied sometimes by golf ball-sized hail, just insane apocalyptic weather that would drive us indoors, and that's normal for a film shoot. If the weather turns, you go and shoot your cover sets, but sometimes those lightning storms would cut power to the whole area for 5 or 6 hours. And that meant even our interiors became difficult to shoot, and we were reduced to what we could shoot using battery-powered lights. So it was a struggle from day one to get the footage into the can. Just to get it done was a really major challenge.
So talk about the storyline, because this then was an experience that you drew from.
So I've known the producer, Aaron Brown, for about 20 years. We met in New York, but he's from Texas, not from this part of Texas. He's from Austin. And our families hadn't seen each other in a while, and he had bought this little house way out in the desert. And he suggested we all meet there for a reunion, the two families. And we did that. And we had a wonderful time, but it was not without some adventure. And one of the things that happened to us was that on a hike that was just Aaron, me, and the kids, our wives were off doing something else that day. One of Aaron's sons wandered off, wanted to go a different way around a bend and wanted to go over the top of the hill. And we said, okay. And he went, and then we couldn't find him when we got around the bend. And so for 45 minutes, that's all, just 45 minutes, he was missing. But it was terrifying because, again, the desert here, it's full of cacti, it's full of rattlesnakes. It is very stark, very remote, very easy to get lost. And there's just a sense of danger everywhere there. And that became the seed of the story. And so there's a significant moment in the movie when one of the children goes missing. But the larger story is really about two families that are both dealing with a crisis that they would prefer to keep secret for the purpose of this trip, for just so that they can enjoy themselves with the other family that they haven't seen in a while.
Distract themselves, I guess.
Yeah, take their mind off it. And you know, it can be difficult if you haven't seen someone in a couple of years to tell them what you're going through. You know, you may prefer just to have fun. But when this child goes missing, it pulls the lid off everything else they're dealing with. And the two families are just forced to cope with it all head on. So it's a drama in that sense, but it's funny. You know, it's also about just the experience of midlife, you know, when you've got children and you've got health issues and you've got, you know, marital issues and money issues, and it's all kind of swirling around you in a vortex. And it's all very normal stuff that we all deal with in our lives. But if you transport it to a place like Terlingua, like Big Bend, West Texas, it can take on, I don't know, almost a cosmic quality. You know, it's a very magical place. It's a place that makes you feel very, very small, but at the same time makes you aware of perhaps being part of something much larger.
Not quite manic versus nature, but it certainly heightens that experience as a human being, right? Trying to deal with life in general.
Yeah, it's not man versus nature. It can be out there very easily, but the story is more human within nature. You know, it's about the way our life and death struggles, which are so different from the life and death struggles of other creatures on the earth, are nevertheless sort of woven into the pattern of things. You know, it's that sense of connecting to the universe and the bigger picture, even while dealing with all of these very earthbound problems.
I love that saying, you know, life is what happens to you when you're making other plans.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. So, you know, this film that you directed, it did well at the film festival.
So we had a really nice festival run, which included HIFF. We were nominated for Best Feature when we were here. And what was even more gratifying than that, though, was that our first screening sold out. And so they gave us a larger venue. And then that venue sold out. So they gave us a second theater running concurrently. And then that theater sold out. So we had, I like to think we had three sellouts, which was just great, you know, because I lived here for many years and I did a lot of work here, hundreds of TV commercials, and then one fairly high profile short film called Chief, which played at Sundance and played around the world. And it was Polynesian in cast and theme and was very, very well received and embraced by the community. But that was a lot of years ago. You know, that was a decade or more ago. And I didn't know to what extent, you know, anyone would remember me or be interested in this movie that takes place in such a different environment. But there's a lot of Hawaii DNA in the movie. It's not just me. One of the actors in the film is Nick Mashangelo, who has been here for many years and well known in the film community, both as an actor and behind the camera. Paul Atkins, absolutely legendary cinematographer who was based here for 40 years. And has done some legendary work, especially National Geographic. And then our first investors in the film, really the instigators of the film, the ones who gave me the reason to think I could possibly go out and make this feature, Paula Rath and Jerry Mayfield, I've known them socially for a very long time. And when my wife was the executive editor of Honolulu Magazine and Paula was writing for The Advertiser, that was the way we got to know each other. But they are film lovers and they were big fans of Chief and they were fans of other work that I've done since. And they actually came to me and said, we want to help you get a movie made. We want to be your first investor. And they were. And with that, you know, once you have a little bit of money, it's a lot easier to go raise more than if you're starting from zero. And so my producer was able to go and raise additional money, mostly in Texas, and put together enough of a budget to make this film. So in that sense, although, you know, I left Hawaii several years ago, the film wouldn't exist without the people here who supported me in the early days of my career and who still do to this day.
That was Brett Wagner, director and writer of the feature film The Big Bend, which opens at Kahala Mall Theaters on Friday. He will be on hand for a Q&A session following the second showing Friday evening. It is time to say goodbye, but tomorrow, FestBack 2024 officially gets underway. We'll bring you coverage on the arrival of canoes at Kualoa Beach Park. Got some feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.